Okay, I think it's time to start our dreaded statistics for today. But as you can see from the title, I think this is going to be actually quite a nice experience to hear Jari talk about this replication crisis and related topics to that. So Jari is from the University of Helsinki, Department of Psychology and Logopedics. And if I remember correctly, you have actually won some teaching awards as well there. So I will then let Jari introduce himself better. Okay.
Onko näistä, mikäs näistä vai? Onko tämä se vai?
Okay. Good day, everyone. So, as presented, I'm Jari Ypsilän from University of Helsinki, and I'm going to talk about replication crisis. And because I wasn't quite sure how many of you will be here, I have made a few slides, but I hope that we can discuss about this topic. So this is not such a lecture. We can discuss about these things. And of course, because native language is not English, if you have problems to understand what I'm saying, feel free to ask. Because I walk from the railway station and I have to go around, tired, but it's going to get better as we get along. So feel free to ask anything you want. In this presentation, I'm not going to bother you with mathematical details. So this is not a statistical or mathematical presentation. Hopefully you are not so disappointed. Of course, if you want, I can write formulas in those whiteboards. But I'm not going to go to the mathematical details. So first of all, are we in crisis? How many of you think that we are in crisis? And the question is why?
I guess you mean it's time. I mean, I think one of the major problems that science has nowadays is the impact that you're supposed to making other people, and then the language you use, the kind of results you use. So you, instead of normally the way science has been going for the last decades and centuries, has been very cautious about what you're doing, trying to replicate. But now, since quality, so quantity primes on quality, then you're supposed to have lots of papers instead of quality papers, and then the way you present those things, I think it's like throwing up all the points that your quality is not.
Yeah, so the problem is that we don't have any more quality and we prefer quantity. That's what you're saying.
Well, not that we don't have quality, but we prime quantity.
More than quality, yeah. Okay. Any other ideas? Why are we in crisis? Or if we aren't, why so? Any ideas? I had all evening.
So also with all the technology, you have more and more data to analyze, and so sometimes the tool to analyze all this and challenging to do that, how to manage all these big data. It's hard to understand what you can expect.
Yeah, so it's harder to analyze data because of the new technologies, and it's hard to learn all those things as an individual researcher. Mm-hmm. Okay, no more ideas. I think that we have two problems. If we are talking about replication crisis or replication problems, we have this statistical point of view, and then we have this practical point of view. And so far, we have talked about these practical things, how to manage data, how to analyze data, how to publish results, how to sell our research results. Because I'm nowadays more a statistician than psychologist, I have concentrated more about the statistical aspects of this replication process. So, what are the current topics? We have problems with statistical interference, hypothesis testing. You probably have heard a lot about it. The main problem is that one of the main indicators that, or main results we so have to have to get the paper published is statistical significant p-value. We want the results, and that's part of the problem. We have problems. How do we assume? What do we think about causal relations? Can we prove that there is some variable X that causes something in the dependent variable? That's the second problem. Then we have other problems. How can we adjust some confounding variables? Is it enough that we just ran analysis of covariance or something like that? So we have a lot of confounding factors affecting in our research in the field of psychology. I assume that most of you are in the field of psychology. Is that correct, or is there someone else also? Sorry about I'm talking about so much about psychology, but of course these problems are same also in the many different areas. They are the same.
I'm not recalling that this is what you thought in communication and share something. This is really connected to the real world. Because every many kind of people in the creative small world, when you are searching for something really special, and for example, if I can show that people can listen to me, you can do for me in this level of the
that's totally correct. It's a question about the validity of our results and how can we generalize the results in the whole population, and that's a very important question. Then we have also a question about this replications. Last couple of years there has been many studies which have tried to replicate classical results in the field of psychology, also in the field of biology and other fields, and at least in psychology and social psychology, mostly those have failed. Or many of those have failed. So, can we really replicate our results? Because of course, that's part of the science, that all results should be replicated, that those became true. Then we have problems with meta-analysis, which has so far considered the best possibility to really examine what effects are real, and then of course we have problems when we are trying to publish this. So, these are the topics which I'm going to discuss in this presentation, and this forms the recent debate in the field of, at least in psychology, but also in many other fields. If we only talk about statistical point of view, I'm not going to go to publishing just yet. These are often offered as a solution to our replication crisis. There is suggestion that we should lower the alpha critical level of our research, the 0.005 or 0.001. There have been suggestions that we should ban totally stop using the p-values and use some kind of other statistics, for example, Bayesian interference, Bayes factors, predicted intervals, false, and so on. We should only use studies with high power, almost actually mean that we should prefer larger and larger sample sizes and not do any studies with low samples. These are the main statistical points. And of course, nowadays, most often people demand that we do some kind of power calculations and also present the effect sizes of our studies. So these four aspects are the main suggestions about concerning statistics in our research. Of course, there's also question about should every study be pre-registered and should the data be available and everything should be open access, but that's not really a statistical question, at least in most ways. Which one of these suggestions is something we should do? What do we do? We can just raise your hand. How many of you think that we should lower the cost level? Two. And others don't want to do it. Or are not sure. Okay, how many of you think we should ban p-values? Not to use those. No one. We all like p-values.
I mean, not ban them, but using vision analysis can be the probably to ban.
But actually, it's banning them. It's not existing. What about banning studies with low power? I agree, but now let's not think about these difficult things such as reality. So just consider we can't put through it. How many of you would like to demand power calculations and effect sizes? Many of you. What about these pre-registered studies and open access? Most of you. Okay. In short time, I will say what I think about this. Maybe I disagree, maybe I don't. Let's see. The first problem, which we haven't discussed enough, in my opinion, is that we are talking about statistics, we are talking about probabilities. And now, if we are doing some kind of hypothesis testing or examining some kind of statistical interference, we are assuming that we have some kind of probability sample. So we have some kind of population where we are generalizing our results. That's the main assumption. That's always been, it will always be so. But in most cases, at least in the field of psychology, we don't have any probability sample. We have some kind of non-probability sample. For example, we are studying those 20 years old psychology students which we can force, in our studies. They may get some credits for that or not, but it's not a probability sample. And the main question is, can we actually use our basic statistical tests to examine different kind of public hypotheses which we are looking in our data? That's very important. And the question is not easy to answer because it depends. Sometimes it's possible that we can assume that the mechanism that is generating the data behaves well enough. So we have, even if we don't have a non-probability sample, it behaves so that we have samples, random sample or systematic stratified or clustered sample in certain population. But that's a theoretical aspect to consider. So there is no way to prove that it's uniform. So first of all, I'm saying that we have to isolate which are the situations we can even do hypothesis testing, and when it's just enough to say that, okay, we have found, for example, 0.5 correlation, and it's interesting, we are not trying to generalize this result to any population. The problem of sampling considers also that sometimes or often, even if we have a probability sample, we have non-response. The words here are Finnish, but I try to explain. So this area here represents the whole population. And we have some kind of sampling frame. But often there are some people in our sampling frame which we don't want to include in our sample. For example, if we are trying to make a study concerning healthy people, there might be people who have some kind of disability or sickness or something other, so we have to drop them out. Or there are some people, this red area here, which are not included in our sampling frame. Classical example from the history, for example, if our sampling frame is some kind of telephone book, and those people who don't have telephone are not included in our sampling frame. Then we have people who don't like to respond. They say, no, we are not participating in your research. That's often the case if we are trying to collect data, for example, using telephone interviews or something like that. They say, no, we are not going to answer, no time, I'm not coming. This movie ticket which you are offering is not enough, or something like that. And of course, there are people who are not responding in certain questions or not doing certain tasks. And of course, all of these are influencing our sample. Usually, one example might be that if we are studying sexuality for the elderly people, in cultural reasons, many might think that they don't want to talk about their sexuality. And it's only those certain elderly people over 70 or over 80 who are talking everything. And our results might be a little bit biased. So all this is influence. This is just the background. So we are talking about samples. Then we are talking about our measurement instruments. Questionnaires, machinery, equipment which we are trying to measure certain things. I think that, at least in the field of psychology, one of the main problems is still that we don't have well, it's wrong to say that we don't have any good measurement instruments, but I would say that we don't have good enough measurement instruments. We have questionnaires, but there is always a problem. For example, I have taken this one example result from Basire, Naumann, and all who are trying to research their research question was, can people predict whether someone is narcissistic by looking their Instagram or Facebook pictures? And as you can see, the dependent variable is one of those narcissism inventories, and we found some, they found some correlations. So, for example, fashionable clothes, there was 0.16 correlation to narcissism inventory. Stylish clothes, 0.22. Expensive clothes, 0.29. And what is the highest? I believe that it's that one. And if the researchers ask what kind of clues those participants were answering these questions, whether certain people or man or woman in the image was narcissistic or not, what cues they use. So, for example, the best correlation was, if I read the lines correctly, this makeup. Meaning that if you have makeup, then people classify you as narcissistic. And there is also these blocked eyebrows for females, and best for all was attractiveness. This is, of course, very good result for us as a researchers, because usually people don't think researchers are so attractive, that's a joke. But anyway, the main problem is that no one in any of those whose image was presented was really, they didn't have narcissistic personality disorder. As you all know, if we question about narcissism about questionnaire, they had self-rated their narcissistic rates. The distribution is very good. So actually, there are some positive sides of the narcissism, as you probably know, those who are psychology. So these are just threats. But we shouldn't sell this result as so that people can really predict narcissism by looking at it. So question is this instrument, this questionnaire, really measuring anything about the real narcissism as we do? There's another example which I would like to show, say. You have probably heard about Cambridge Analytica. Everyone, yeah. Well, in my opinion, of course, that firm had done very unethical things about handling their data. But the main problem is that they are assuming, what thing they are selling, that we have some kind of, I try to draw, that we have some kind of behavior. What links people click in Facebook or like in Facebook, what they are writing in their Facebook role. And they use it to predict personality. using that prediction, they are trying to influence, or they at least say that they are trying to influence the election results, for example, in Brexit or United States presidential election. We know that we can do this. We can predict personality traits in certain kind of behavior. Basically, correlations are about 0.2, 0.3, so not large, but if we are using some kind of machine learning algorithms, we might get better results. What did they have? They had certain sorting, 5 questionnaire and Myers-Briggs typing. Those were the main tools. Now, there's a lot of questions about quality of Myers-Briggs. We are not going to talk about that. But anyway, so they are bringing in the results of the simple question. And those of you who are psychologists know that why we are using questions. Because we don't have any better answers. So if you answer in a certain way in some questionnaire, it's just a reflection about your personality. It's not your personality. We all know, at least those of you who are really studying or researching, doing psychological research, know that our results, when we are predicting some real-life event using these personality questionnaires, are usually quite poor. So there is no much predictive power. Maybe 0.3 correlation at best. We have almost no idea. There are some studies, but quite a few, how personality is affecting how people behave in elections. So we have prediction error here, and it's huge. And then we have quality questions, what we are really measuring in here. And then we have huge prediction error in this part. What we are really doing? In my opinion, they didn't do anything real. It was just a sales. So they didn't have, even if you use machine learning cannot override these problems which we have in this causal path over here. The most, what I would do if I was this unethical salesperson doing some kind of same thing, I would try to predict directly this fact. Because we can make predictions how people behave. If you are liking the speech of Donald Trump, then you probably like something about it. If you are liking a certain political parties, or if you are writing lots of stuff, for example, in the against European Union or something like that, that's more important information compared with your personality. And after that, social media is nice for that we can trust. If we present information well enough, then it spreads. People who like it, they share it, as we all know. We should say everyone shares what we like. So we just need to give that information. So the important question is what we are really measuring, and that's also the question which you wrestling with, that can we really generalize the results in those real-world situations we are trying to do so. Of course, we have many confounding variables or covariates, whatever word we want to use. This is rather small, but I will give you information. What are the assumptions that we can control certain variables in our analysis? What are the main assumptions, for example, analysis of covariates? What we are assuming? That's technical assumptions. Any idea? What are also assumptions of some personal regression analysis? This is the best.
I think that the covariates can have an influence on the results, so try to control the product, the product,
yes. So we are assuming that covariates actually make a difference.
Yeah.
Not a statistical assumption, but still it's an important point.
Most on the right knowledge.
Almost. Maybe a little bit different. I think you are probably thinking of the right thing. In your field, because there are many other, you use analysis of covariates or regression analysis in your studies. I believe that those are quite difficult in every field. Let's think about these assumptions of in traditional regression analysis or any linear model. Because there's no paper, I'm just trying to find some program here. Is there any word or notepad? Let's see. Tuos. And of course now, because I'm improvising, this can be go totally wrong, but just hanging there. In traditional regression analysis, we are assuming, of course, linear relations. Because we are predicting using the straight line. Of course, we can have some kind of nonlinear effects if they are linear by the parameters, but basically it's still linear relationship. We are assuming independent observations. We are assuming normally distributed errors. Note that we don't assume that our variables are normally distributed. We are assuming that our errors, prediction errors, are normally distributed. We are assuming constant error variance. And we are also, well, actually this basically covers it. So we are assuming that all the levels of prediction, the error variance is constant. And most often in statistics, we write these assumptions that error terms are identically and independently distributed with the normal distribution with the expected value of zero and some constant error variance. This is shorthand for all of these assumptions. So this is the assumptions of every linear model. Now in every linear model, this is now statistics 101, I apologize, but it's interesting, I hope so. Just tell me it's not. If we are doing some kind of linear models, we are always examining the independent effect of certain parameters. So, for example, if we have some kind of equation that certain dependent variable is some constant plus some slope parameter for variable x1 plus some other constant for some other parameter and plus the error term, when we are examining this parameter, it's always conditional compared to this one. So we are always examining the individual effect of certain variable, even if we want it, or even if you're not wanting it. So basically, when we are controlling other confounding variables or covariates, we are just including the main effects in our equation. That's basically the short way to say. But what we are really assuming, additionally to these basic assumptions, we are assuming that there is no interaction between these two variables, this one which we are controlling and this one which we are interested in. Because if there is an interaction, for example, that relationship for example, for male is positive and for female the relationship is negative, there's no way to control the effect of gender because for certain values the effect can be other way around and for certain values it can be again other way around. So we assume that there is no interaction. But we are also assuming, and that's problematic, that distribution of these two variables are overlapping. So, for example, if we are examining the difference, for example, for a certain variable, and we are trying to control age, we have to assume that the age values are distributed so, for example, this is some kind of experimental group versus control group, that the age distribution in experimental group is almost equal as in the control group. So the distribution between groups are overlap. And this is one of the main problems in many studies because no one, at least I have never seen that we are really examining what is the distribution of those variables we are controlling. This is a classical article, at least in my point, classical, I don't know, have you ever heard about it? Probably not. But a couple of years ago, when our government was thinking about gay and lesbian marriages, So should gay and lesbian couples have right to get married? This article popped up quite often because, of course, one of the most important questions is why don't anyone think of the children? So how is this influence for the children? Because if gay and lesbian couples can get married, they can adopt, and they can have, so they can have and raise children. Alan examined in Canada how gay and lesbian, is there any difference of children of gay and lesbian couples, how they differ compared with the children of the normal heterosexual couples in based on their child's education. So, do they graduate? Do they attend high school? What kind of grades they get? And the main result was that gay parents, if the child was girl and they had and she had gay a couple as a parent, they performed worse, and for the lesbian parents, the effect was similar, both girls and boys. So they witnessed that compared to the heterosexual couples, gay and, child of gay and lesbian parents had lower education. They perform little bit worse in school and so on. Now the main problem is that, of course, if we think about the heterosexual couples, most of the children are biological. But if we think about the gay and lesbian parents, most of the children are adopted. And the legislation in Canada hasn't been so far, so actually most of these children are adopted quite old. And as we can all think, everything can happen. There is a reason that these children are given, they have given to the adoption agencies. So the distribution of these background variables is not identical. There is a lot of confounding factors which we simply cannot control, because heterosexual couples, there is almost no adoptions in this data, and for the gay and lesbian parents, there is everyone is adopted. And this is something we just simply cannot control in our analysis. Affecting everybody. So we have to assume, so we can control some variables, that these distributions over. Of course, there are a lot of statistical techniques to solve this problem if distribution don't overlap, for example, propensity score estimates and so on, do some kind of matching. But unfortunately, at least I haven't seen that done very often. If you look at the tables, they just say that these variables are controlled, and that's all. And then we hope that everything is fine. Second example about the controlling comes from Institute of Criminology and Legal Policy from University of Helsinki. A couple of years ago in Finland, we had this thing called immigration crisis. We all know that. So there was a lot of problems about or discussion about are immigrants doing more crimes compared to that. Well, again, humans, normal these people. And the basic result based on this study was that if person was coming from Africa or Middle East, there was almost 17 times more likely that he was doing some kind of sexual offense compared to the main population, and also some kind of theft or robbery compared to the traditional Finnish population. So these numbers, which don't, probably you don't see very well, but you see that those are quite large, are the odds ratios, or actually the risk ratios, in doing some kind of criminal act. And these results remain significant, even if we control gender, age, income, and area factors. But again, one of the main problems, can we really control those factors? Because if we think about the traditional refugee, at least the income is very specific distribution, for, and the distribution of income in Finland otherwise is totally different. And what we are seeing, so I'm not saying that, for example, there are many difficult things, for example, problems in Africa or Middle East. I'm not saying that those people are not doing any crimes. But that's not my point. I'm just saying that if we are trying to rule out causal reasons, we simply cannot control, say that we have controlled these background variables and still say that we have observed some kind of relationship. And as you can see, based on which variables are controlled, there is a large deviation in these risk estimates. And usually, it's an indication of some kind of instability. So when we are controlling things, we really have to assume that we have matching samples based on the distribution. And of course, that there is no interactions and other effects. So every time we are running some kind of statistical model, we have to make sure that we are at least aware what kind of assumptions we are really making. Of course, we are talking about probabilities. So the question is, does this violation of certain assumption also influence our result? But that's the other question. Then we can talk about causal relations. How many of you have heard about this question, discussion about medical drugs in healthcare? So, for example, depression medication and how it's affecting all those side effects and it's not really working and so on. Have you heard about this question? Discussion? Some of you. For example, there is this web page called Mad in America, which is discussing about problems with medicalization. And for example, they are citing quite often this study of Marshall and Chopin, which the main result is that people not using antipsychotic medicine are actually performing better compared to those who are using anti-catholic myths. So the main idea is that they are trying to say that people shouldn't use those anti-catholic myths. But this is really a causal relationship. No, because this is not actually any kind of experiment. Harlow and Jobert, they looked at this 15 years follow-up. What letter people have used, stopped using this antipsychotic or other psychiatric medication. And of course, there's a reason why people are stopping their medication. The main reason in most cases is probably that they are feeling better. And that's why stopping the medication isn't the cause to get better. It's just a consequence. So we are breaking heavily our causality assumptions. This is not the cause, this is the effect which we are observing. But this is the result which are now people are selling in the United States, that people shouldn't use antipsychotic medication because it causes psychotic episodes. Of course, we know that every medicine has side effects and so on. So, of course, question is problematic if there's a lot of side effects, for example, depression medication. It's something that everyone should consider. If you are experiencing side effects, then you should change your medication or get some other treatment. But still, that's the other question. Here's the other picture from the same study, and as you can see, that they saw that there is almost 79% of those people who are on antipsychotic medication have some kind of psychotic activity. Of course, that's why they are eating the medication. Those who are not, there are very few who had some psychotic activity. Actually, the main question is, if these people had psychotic activity, why didn't they get any medication? That's an interesting question. Now, let's talk about p-values. What is p-value?
It's the probability that like every time you run a statistical test, you're comparing your distribution with a certain standard, and might be a different distribution for zero or whatever. And it's the probability that your distribution is similar or different to the other thing you're comparing.
Okay. Other ideas?
The hypothesis is true. As to something, everyone is different.
Other ideas? That's your goal.
How extreme your result is in the long run?
Yeah. The main problem in the p-values, and the frequentistic approach of statistical reasoning, is that p-value is conditional probability of the data, or more precisely, the observed parameter, which can be correlation coefficient, which can be mean difference, some kind of regression coefficient, whatever you want. So, if the probability to observe certain parameter, assuming that our null hypothesis is true, and again in the long run, here we have example pictures. As you can see, I think that I'm trying to present that these points form the total population. So in here we have all the observations in certain population, and we are, as you can see, there is no relationship between this variable and this variable, so there is no correlation in that population. So null hypothesis, correlation coefficient in population zero, is really true. Now we are sampling. So these red dots are sample one. There is about 10 observations, or maybe a little more. I don't have time to calculate. And we observe correlation 0.3 in this sample. Then we take another sample, these blue dots, and we observe correlation minus 0.47. And those samples are equal probability, so those are all possible samples. We do possible samples in our total samples. And now we repeat this sampling with the same sample size 1,000 times. And after some little bit transformations, you can see that the variation in our samples is following quite exactly the distribution with decreases of freedom of sample size minus 2. So this is just a simple test for correlation, significance correlation coefficients. Of course, in the real cases, we don't have possibility to take 1,000 different samples in certain populations. We only have one. So we are comparing our one result to this theoretical distribution and thinking how extreme this result really is. But this leads to the main problem, because every sample is as likely as other. We have no way of knowing do we have we observed sample from here such by coincidence. We know that in the long run it's a rare occasion, but it's still possible. If you are buying a lottery ticket, you know that your probability of winning is almost zero. But still, in every one or maybe two, means at least some. And that is why one of the main problems concerning p-values is that those are the main result of our part. For our studies. No one has ever said that p-value should be a publication criteria. That if your result is statistically not significant, then you should throw the manuscript out and not publish it. And if your result is significant, then you should, everything is fine and you should publish your results. That's how no one has ever intended for this statistical reasoning to be taken. But we know that if we are trying to offer papers with all the results which are not significant, it usually gets rejected actually, I would say that we don't have reputation crises that sponsoring statistics. We have reputation crises that sponsoring the way the papers are published. So we have publication crises.
The same problems
are also concerning traditional confidence intervals, which are just special cases of p-values. But of course, there will be a little bit more information about parameters. One idea, of course, is to use this Bayesian reasoning. By using Bayesian reasoning, we can really calculate so-called posterior probability. So if we really want to ask what is the probability of observing, for example, alternative hypotheses conditional to the observed data, we can calculate. That's what we really want to know. But the problem is that we have to also include some kind of prior assumptions, prior distribution, when we are calculating our posterior distribution. So we should have always some kind of prior assumptions how certain parameter estimates behave. And at least in the field of psychology, we don't have almost none, we don't have any idea how certain parameters could be behaving. In other fields, for example, in physics or biology, there are more. But, for example, in biology, for psychology, social psychology, and medicine, there is almost none. Of course, we can use so-called non-informative priors, but basically the interpretation is usually almost the same as the traditional approach. Of course, Bayesian reasoning is also a little bit more complex to calculate, and there is no counterpart for every classical analysis in Bayesian world that is yet possible. If you look about the Bayes factors, which are in which we are comparing two posterior distributions or two posterior hypotheses or probabilities.
So in Bayes factors, we are comparing the posterior uncertainty about alternative hypotheses and the null hypotheses, and then we have some kind of classifications, how strong evidence that is going to provide to us. For example, that over Bayes factor over 100 is decisive evidence for alternative hypotheses. And there are lots of papers which are suggesting that we should ban p-values and use Bayesian reasoning and, for example, these Bayes.
But if we look the relationship between how this Bayes factor is behaving compared to traditional p-values.
Maybe I make this little bit larger, this image, so you can see something.
So, first of all, even if you do Bayesian reasoning, it's still influenced by the sample size. So, for example, in these images, we have different sample sizes, 100, 200, 400, and 1,000, and we are performing just a basic Bayesian alternative to that, normal t-tests. And in the x scale, there is classical p-value, and in the y scale, there is space. And the red line is the Bayes factor, where we are calculating the Bayes factor for the null hypothesis, and black is the Bayes factor for the alternative hypothesis. So we are just changing the divisor and divider other way around. And if we are calculating the result for the Bayes factor of this alternative hypothesis, you see that it behaves almost precisely as traditional p-value. If we don't have any prior assumption about to prefer certain hypotheses. So these are calculated so that we don't have any a priori assumptions how which hypothesis is more correct. So this behavior almost the same. The other way around, the image was a little bit different, but still the basic idea is precisely the same. So if we use some kind of cut point for the Bayes factor, it's often recommended. So over 3 is substantial evidence. We are actually using same criteria as a p-value under 0.05. So if we don't have any prior probabilities which can be included in our proper hypothesis, if we are using these Bayes factors, we are not getting any additional information compared to the traditional p-values and test statistics. And I think that this is one of the major problems in current statistical discussion, that we are assuming that there is some kind of new statistics or new way to calculate our results. It is saving everything. No, it's not. We have the same uncertainty, certainly, in all of our research. So if we are really... So there is no statistical way to make certain that certain individual study is true or not true. We are always talking about problems. So even if we change the ways how we are calculating or analyzing our data, the main problem still remains. Of course, there are many advantages in the Bayesian approach. I don't deny those. What I would like to think that we have actually a toolbox of different kind of analysis. We have classical frequentist reasoning, p-values, confidence intervals, and so effect sizes, and so on. We have Bayesian reasoning. We have information criteria. We have likelihood-based reasoning, and so on. And those are just simple tools to analyze our data, which is best in certain situations, is theoretical question. That's why, because I'm participating quite a lot of studies and papers, and at least I have noticed that in the last couple of years, there have been quite a lot of review comments that no, we are not trusting your results, you should run some kind of Bayesian analysis. Well, we can do it, but usually it doesn't change anything. At least if you don't have any real information in addition to our analysis or to our data. Then we always have this concept of effect size, which is extremely important. One should always remember that effect size is qualitative measure which is based on your observed data. So the question, when you are calculating the effect size, you are not usually making any assumptions about the total effect size in the population. And of course, if we try to compare which effect size is weak, which is medium, which is strong, it's always based on the field of the study and the whole experiment. For example, in psychology, our effect sizes are usually quite weak. We consider 0.3 correlation interesting because so many different things are influencing how people behave. But if, for example, in biology, biological researcher, you would probably laugh when you observe 0.3 correlation. These are rather boring, you probably know all of those. But this slide is something I'm going to show. Is the concept of effect size familiar to you? No, no. So I'm not going to take your time to explain this. But basically, this is just a collection to present you that we have very different criteria. What is strong effect? What is small effect? What is medium effect? For example, Cohen, Jacob, originally presented that small effect is correlation coefficient, which is under 0.1. But if we look at the other reference, you might see that small effect is correlation under 0.2. So we have quite a lot of variations in different fields. So, effect sizes are always relative to the research subject. And of course, one should always think, does this result have any practical meaning? Of course, for example, if we have population-based some kind of register study, and we have observed sample size of maybe 1 million or some kind of other big data, and we observe small effect, that it still can affect thousands of people. Or if we observe something happening in childhood and it has small effect in relationship with that something in the adulthood, then it might still be interesting. For example, if that we have some risk factors in childhood which are causing cancer or some other bad things in adulthood, why not take risk at all, even if we know the effect is small? But then we have also research questions where we are really assuming that the effect size should be very high. If we have cross-sectional studies, we usually want to demand very high effect sizes, so it has any practical meaning.
these are just formulas to change different effect size statistics to one other, but those are rather boring, so let's skip those. You only need those if you are doing some kind of meta-analysis or thing, or other things. Then we have this concept of statistical power. Again, concerning hypothesis testing. So statistical power is probability to react the null hypothesis if it really is wrong. And what is influenced in statistical power is our alpha level, so risk level, effect size, and of course sample size. Basically, if we think about philosophically, null hypothesis is always wrong. Because if your null hypothesis is that mean difference in certain population is zero, so there's no difference between male and female, the question is about measurement accuracy. If I say that average, for example, intelligence in male is 100.000000000001, what is the probability that average of female is exactly the same in certain populations? It's zero, because it's a question about measurement accuracy. So actually, the null hypothesis is always wrong if we are just comparing for zero. Of course, we are assuming that a difference or correlation or whatever is so small that there is no practical significance. But that's why the sample size is effective, because if we have larger samples, even the smaller and smaller effects became statistically significant.
Sorry, you just said, I think, that if your measurement is meaningful, that you should use that as an effect size. Right? So, like, amount of zeros or whatever you say.
Yeah.
But if it affects statistical power and non-standardized effect size, how does that then, how can you determine the power if you don't really have a standardized way of giving your effect size?
If you don't have any standardized way to give your effect size, then you have no way to estimate the power. Of course, Jukoban can always run some kind of pilot study and use and calculate some kind of standardized measures of effect size based on that. But if there is no a priori effect size estimates available, then there's no way of calculating statistical power.
And is it always possible to go from a non-standardized effect size, for instance, the use of weight measures, if you have a certain temperature difference, for instance? Is it always straightforward to go from non-standardized effect size to standardized effect size?
Usually it is, but of course not always. Here is the example of statistical power calculation in correlation studies. So here in the X scale we have correlation coefficients, and different lines present the statistical power. So this purple one means that we are observing this effect as significant with a risk level 0.05 with 90% certainly. And as we can see, if our standardized effect size estimate is 0.1, we need sample size little over 1,000. So as you can see, the power is a function of sample size and effect size, and with smaller effects we always need larger samples to observe those. And this is one of the main problems if we have low power studies, because of course if we have, for example, 100 research groups which are running the same study,
for example, some kind of biological or measuring some kind of brain waves or something like that, it's expected that 5 of those will find significant results just by coincidence. That's the expected value. But we all know that how science behaves. So if we only publish these statistically significant results, those 5 studies are those which are going to live on. And those 95 are just put in the file drawer and nobody finds them. But nobody finds them. But the main problem is still not that we should always ban studies with low power. That's not my recommendation. What I'm recommending and actually demanding, and I'm not the only one, you should be giving me across all the others also, that we should replicate our results. So we shouldn't use p-values as publishing criteria. That's the main problem. Not the low power, but the thing that we are only publishing significant results. There is coffee break starting quite soon, but this is the last slide I'm going to present before coffee break. Usually, if you write your publication, how many of you have already published many papers, or at least one, couple? Usually, when I'm publishing research, I'm using the data sets which are quite old. The data gathering has been done up over 10 years ago, so there are longitudinal analyses. And in the last couple of years, the response from the reviewers has been, please justify your sample size using the power calculations. How the hell I can justify my sample size when the project started over 10 years ago? I might be quite good statistician, but I'm not inventing a time machine. And flying over 10 years ago, when I was in the elementary school, and said, come talk to research, say, gather more data, you have low power study. So, the concept of so-called cost of power is ridiculous. You never should use it. Only if you have some kind of pilot study, and you are trying to examine what kind of effects you should observe. So, if you have already collected your data and reviewer asks, please provide some power calculations, because observed power, if it totally is ridiculous concept. So, meaning, if you have observed statistically significant result, what is the probability of observed statistically significant result? It's 1. Because you have already observed that. If you don't didn't observe statistically significant results, it's something under 1. And so these are the basic articles concerning the cost of power, which one can use if someone is asking that please provide power calculations when everything is already done. Of course, there's a real problem. But if you have small sample size and low power study and you find significant evidence, it's possible that this is type 1 error. That's the real problem. And I'm not going to deny that. But then it's actually not your problem. You are just basically presenting the results. And we should always assume that our scientific community is going to replicate those results. or you are going to replicate your results, or you are going to offer some kind of benchmark. It's calculate the effect size and then doing the measurements. So power calculations are tools for planning your result. If you have some kind of knowledge, what is the true effect size based on the previous literature, you can plan your results, ask how many observations you need, and then run your collect your data, run your analysis. It saves time, it saves money, and so on. That is the effect size large. But nowadays, it's very unfortunate that reviewers are just testing post hoc power because it doesn't really make any statistical sense. Okay, I believe that they said that now is some time for the coffee break. I have no idea how long the coffee break is going to be. Do you have any idea of the time table? Half an hour. Okay, so let's continue when it's 4 o'clock. Thank you.